Hello, and welcome to New Books in Music. I'm your host, Jordan Stokes, and today we'll be talking to Phil Ford, Associate Professor of Musicology at the Indiana University Jacobs School of Music, about his 2013 book, Dig, Sound and Music in Hip Culture. The book traces the hip sensibility from its roots in the African-American subcultures that arose in cities such as New York and Chicago in the aftermath of the Great Migration through the beat poets of the 1950s and the 1960s counterculture movement. Ford marshals a wide array of sources, newspaper columns, jazz improvisations, political posters, liner notes, diaries, and amateur acetate recordings, all grappling in creative, illuminating, and sometimes painful ways with the impossibility of capturing the lived experience of hipness. Phil Ford, welcome to New Books in Music. So we traditionally begin by asking you a few things about yourself. How did you decide to become a musicologist?
Well, my background is as a performing musician. I was a pianist studying classical piano way back in the day. And at a certain point, I was taking classes in music, and at a certain point just got fascinated not only by what I could how I could represent music not only as a player, but in writing. And it's kind of funny because although, I still play a little bit, in a way, those early experiences have come back in my writing and trying to write about experience that we can call kind of performative. So that's kind of my first road into musicology. As for, why I wrote Dig or how I got into that, I actually took a couple of years off in graduate school where I was just working in a museum and was sort of running into a lot of characters wearing goatees, a lot of kind of mid-90s era hipsters. And at a certain point, it occurred to me, okay, there's this idea that hipness is this kind of ineffable uniqueness of the individual. But if that's true, then why are these guys all wearing like identical goatees? And I started thinking about hipness as, I guess you could say it like really simply, like a code, but then maybe more complexly as an aesthetic, as an ideal of beauty, both, beauty in terms of art, like, what makes a piece of music worth listening to, but also an aesthetic ideal of the self conceived as an artistic creation. And from that intuition that hipness has something to do with aesthetic self-creation, I just started thinking about how this idea really has this whole history, a kind of a history, an intellectual and cultural history in the United States, and started working backwards and ended up, spending a lot of time in the period from the 1930s through the 1960s and 70s.
And I think some things that you treat very wonderfully in the book come through right in that, both the idea that hipness, first of all, is an encounter with some external object, which is meant to be hip, but it's also inward looking, right? Both at the same time. And then also that if hipness is something that you can sit down and write about analytically and do a history of hipness, that kind of means that hipness can't be what it has always been supposed to be.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the same thing can kind of be said, at least something like that, about Zen, which is the subject of your first chapter. It's an interesting introduction to this book on hipness and music to go to Eastern religion. And I think the thing that strikes me is that, well, you can have books that are Zen books, and then you can have books that are about Zen. And there's maybe some overlap between the two, but there's sort of different projects, right?
Right.
And can you explain a little bit more? What's the use that Zen has for your project here? Why is that the opening shot?
Because I wanted to figure out some way of grasping something that's really hard to grasp. At least the way I understand this aesthetic or sensibility, I guess I use that word more often, sensibility of hipness, something that makes it really hard to grasp, makes it, as I say throughout the book, kind of resistant to thought, which is that as a sensibility, it's about the experience in the present moment, like right here, right now. I invite the listener of this podcast to stop right now and say, like, where are you? What room are you in? Are you walking? What clothes are you wearing? What's the feel of the clothing on your skin? What's the feel of the temperature of the room that you're in, et cetera? That kind of sense of immediacy, snapping us out of almost a kind of a kind of psychogenic fugue that we're in all the time, where we're sort of almost sleepwalking through our days. This was an absolutely central kind of aspect. I think really the central aspect of this hip sensibility. And because of that, this kind of attempt to grasp something that really is sort of almost ungraspable in words, or like the moment you use words already, you're kind of distanced from that ineffable immediate moment of experience. You know, people in what I call hip culture, which is this sort of intellectual sphere of people who are kind of, you know, kind of fascinated by this, what is it, idea or sensibility or whatever it is, this hipness. You know, all of these figures in this kind of intellectual hip culture are kind of looking for some way to frame what can't be framed, to say what can't be said. And Zen was really fascinating to a lot of intellectuals from this early period, from in the late 40s, early 50s, when Zen first starts appearing in the American scene. Immediately, people like the Beats, most famously, and a lot of other people besides, grasp that this is a philosophy, kind of philosophy, but not really, a philosophy of the ungraspable, a philosophy of that which cannot be philosophized. And so Zen becomes like kind of a front and center intellectual figure. That said, you know, I kind of grabbed onto Zen and wrote about it at length in that first chapter, not necessarily because like, oh, everybody in what I'm calling hip culture is all about Zen. So that's not true. It's just that Zen is one of a number of kind of inputs, one of a number of sort of influences or things kind of entering this sort of genealogy of hip culture. It's a particularly distinguished one, is one that particularly fires the imagination of people starting in the 1950s. But it's just one example of like a much larger array of intellectual and artistic commitments. But I wanted to increase the magnification on like one of those commitments, one of those things. And Zen just kind of early on, even before I really knew much about Zen, I had any practical experience with it, just kind of captured my imagination. So, you know, I kind of followed my nose on that one, just deciding like this would be a nice entry point to this thing that's otherwise very hard to talk about.
And the other thing that it does is that it is in particular an entry point that is itself notoriously hard to talk about. So you kind of begin to introduce the reader to the sort of mental motions back and forth over this line of what you can talk about and not, that they're going to have to sort of go along with you all through the book. Now, another big input, of course, and here's where the music side of New Books in Music comes in, I guess, is jazz, right? And I think that you could think of this in a way as a history of jazz reception, because the rest of the book is laid out more or less chronologically. Like there's sort of a 1930s, 1940s piece, and then you focus on the Beats in the 1950s, and then kind of on counterculture movement of the 1960s before focusing in on these two case studies on Norman Mailer and John Benson Brooks for the last two chapters. And each time that you move through this sort of progression, the big historical progression, the relationship to hipness and the relationship to jazz specifically seems to change. So let's go back to the first of those in the chapter Somewhere Nowhere, where you talk about the Precambrian era of hipness.
Yeah.
What did hipness mean for that community? And maybe actually the best question is, what is that community?
Yeah, good question. Actually, in a way, one of the very hardest questions I had to wrestle with in writing this book. You know, I was just thinking about it this morning. It's something that occurs to me now looking at this book, and the book was published a couple of years ago, so I've got a bit of distance from it. What occurs to me now is how persistently I'm always interested in things which are a little bit like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. You know, the sort of, you know, something's in it. You can see the reflected glow in the faces of the characters that open up the box. And you know there's a box. You can even describe the box, but you can't say what's in the box. I'm really interested in stuff like that. And so in the chapter that you just made reference to, Somewhere Nowhere, you know, I'm really fascinated in exactly the question you asked, like, who were these people in the very early, what I call Precambrian era of hipness? Precambrian because, you know, we know that there was a multiplicity of life forms in the Precambrian, but because they all were soft-bodied, we only had the vaguest idea of what they were. We know there was something there, but we don't know exactly what it was, or we have ideas, but that's a kind of a black box, right? Kind of like a Pulp Fiction briefcase. Likewise, that really early sort of emergent hit culture of the 1930s, which was really a kind of a product, a social product of the Great Migration, people moving northward into African Americans moving into northern United States cities like Detroit, Chicago, New York, especially New York. You see a project of self-stylization in public spaces and a kind of self-stylization that marks a certain kind of apartness from society and a society experienced by migration, Great Migration era African Americans and African Americans for decades thereafter as a fundamentally unfree, unjust, racist society. And so this project of self-stylization is a self-stylization against this understood background of racial oppression. But the whole thing about it is that it's not like a verbalized posture. It's an existential one. It's a lived one. It's something that has to do with how you're turned out and your appearance, your clothes, your shoes, your hat, the rake and angle of your hat, the kind of music you listen to, the way you listen to it. It's a, you know, to use that a word that's been kind of worn thin by overuse, a lifestyle, a style of life. Life, not, you know, that we can kind of objectify or reify as a thing, but like it's living. And it's really hard to put living in words, right? I can show you a life. I can write a biography of, for example, John Benson Brooks, which I do in the last chapter. I can show you a life, but I can't show you living, right? Any more than I can, you know, I can show you water. I can go to the waterfall with a bucket and take out a bucket of water, but I can't bring the waterfall home in that bucket. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that then what you rely on, right, are the people who are commenting on this this culture.
Exactly.
And what's interesting to me is that they seem to have encountered the same problem that you are talking about right there, that already in the moment of writing it down, they're recognizing that this can't quite be written down. At least that's the thing that comes out of Dan Burley's Backdoor Stuff column, which was a really interesting find.
Yeah, backdoor stuff is something I was hoping that if people got anything from this book, it would be to recognize, get into some of the more obscure figures I got into, like Seymour Cram is another, especially Dan Burley, just finding his Amsterdam Daily News columns on of social reportage. I mean, just like stuff that he sees in the Harlem Street Corner and he writes about, you know, really valuable early observations of an emergent hip culture. And he himself is writing about it kind of from, I don't want to say from its own point of view, but he's trying to get as close as he can. Like he's trying, he's well aware that whatever hipness is, he's not calling it hipness, by the way. Nobody talked about hipness until the later 40s. But he's aware that whatever this thing is, what hep cats are doing on the streets, that it has something to do with like not life as some objectified, reified, congealed object, but living. And he tries to perform living in his prose, like the way he sort of, as I say, somewhere in the book, he sort of sticks and moves like a boxer. But even there, there's a sort of a distance between observer and observed. And there's always this kind of vanishing point where you're like, you're trying to get close to the sociological urtext, the originary moment of hipness. And yet it's, again, it's one of those kind of Pulp Fiction briefcases. It's a sort of a black box. The moment that you're commenting on it, talking about it, is the moment that you're kind of out of it. There's a line that I quote in the third chapter of this on the beats from, and this is getting back to the Zen thing, from the, it's the introductory verse of the Zen koan, Ruyun's Constant Principle. And the line goes, even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. And that kind of puts it pretty squarely. Like the moment you call it thus, the moment you characterize it is the moment that you've abstracted it, pulled it out of the stream of life, and made it something slightly other than what it is in that moment of living.
That actually transitions very nicely to the next chapter, which is on the beats, because as they emerge here, they seem to be people who recognized that where knowledge doesn't reach, you shouldn't speak. And yet they then try very, very hard to speak.
Exactly.
That's almost the whole point of their project. Now, yep. Here, again, one of the things that's great about this book is the richness and the variety of the sources that you're drawing from. And you sort of walk us through this experience a few times where you introduce what the source is. So in this case, it's a collection of acetate recordings made by John Cleland Holmes, where you have the beats are kind of at a party and someone breaks out the recorder and they are spouting off their thoughts and their poetry and their jazz improvisations of a certain kind.
Yeah.
And you say, well, you might think when you walk into the library and encounter these recordings, this is going to unlock it all. This is going to be the true hip experience, the actual thing. And then you walk us through sort of the inevitable disappointment that every time you find one of these things, it doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how much of that is recounting your own engagement with it? Were you actually expecting to find sort of the Rosetta Stone of hipness from these?
Yes and no. I mean, like, yeah, of course, as a scholar, I'm probably not the only person who became a professional scholar who was heavily influenced by Indiana Jones, you know?
Yes.
Like the Indiana Jones and the, what's the first one? I want to say Temple of Doom, but I don't think that's it.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark. I always get that wrong. Temple of Doom is the one that sucks. No, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, because that moment where they open the Ark, right? I just made a connection to my earlier metaphor, the Pulp Fiction briefcase. Like, they actually open it. They open the black box. And what happens? Everybody's heads explode, except for Indy, who keeps his eyes closed. And that's kind of a neat metaphor, because it's just like, on the one hand, we did it. We got to the fundamental, originary truth, the Ark of the Covenant. And yet you can't look in it. You can't look at it. You can't look directly at it. And so, like, there's always this kind of strange constitutive tension in scholarship between that hunger to find the lost Ark, to find the Rosetta Stone, the missing object, the thing that's going to make it all make sense. And yet at the same time, this kind of awareness that it's a moving object. It's like trying to follow the moon. Like, the thing just keeps staying steadily in front of you. And, you know, in the chapter on the beats, I write that there's a sort of a melancholy that comes from that. Certainly in the Beats' own recording, where it's obvious that they're recording themselves and they're thinking all these thoughts, like, how do we capture the ineffable moment? Oh, recordings. You have to understand, these recordings were made in 1949. The experience of hearing yourself on a recording is ubiquitous now. There's probably nobody who, like, makes it to age 10 in, you know, the United States without hearing his or her voice, right? But, like, in 1949, it was a weird experience to hear yourself, to record yourself and be like, wow, you know, what does this mean? And you can tell that they're sort of locking onto this idea, like, oh, recordings can render that ineffable moment, that moment that always shrinks from our grasp, can render it in sound. And yet not really, you know, and that comes out really clearly in, like, Pull My Daisy, which is a, you know, short film, half hour long film that I discuss at the end of this chapter. So, you know, getting back to your question. Yeah. I mean, that's something I kind of feel in myself. And something that I think is, I found an interesting resonance with the experience of the beats, the undercurrent of melancholy that goes with that kind of impossible project of memory and recuperation.
That definitely, it comes across very strongly. And there's a melancholy that they themselves seem to sometimes feel. And then there's a sort of secondary melancholy that we can feel at this historical remove, right?
Yeah.
To see some of those hopes kind of come to naught.
Yeah.
Now, can you speak a little bit more about the relationship of the beats to jazz? I think that's a very interesting thing that comes across here, because one thing that seems to emerge from these acetate recordings is that Jack Kerouac seems to not have really understood jazz very well, right? And yet, maybe for the purposes of hipness, that may not actually matter as much as you might think that it would.
Yeah, that's another good point, because I think people who write about Kerouac and jazz tend to get hung up on the question of, like, well, how musical was he? Like, how much specific jazz knowledge did he have? Kerouac actually wrote a somewhat ill-fated jazz column. I forget which magazine carried it, which jazz fans hated because they were like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And people have tended to rehearse that question. And one thing that actually comes out of the acetate recordings, you can hear him trying to improvise along with another guy named Seymour Wise, one of, like, a boyhood friend of his. They're trying to sing, improvise a duo line over Hot House, which is this Dizzy Gillespie bebop number, which has, you know, kind of a tricky, especially like a tricky bridge. And clearly he kind of knows some basic things, but he's not a jazz musician. Like, you can tell he doesn't have a jazz musician's trained ear. And also, like, why should we care? Like, why should we expect him to? He's a writer. He's not a musician. And yet there's something about his writing, the way that he's always advertising his incredibly intense jazz-fueled experiences that makes you feel sort of like, well, if you're going to write that check, you're going to have to be able to cash it. Like, you need to have some kind of knowledge to back up what you say is this incredibly intense experience. And yet I think the thing with Kerouac and the Beats in general, and also with this hip sensibility that I'm talking about, there's a really large element of play and make-believe in it. You know, there's a way in which these guys are entering into their experience, as I say in this chapter, sort of like kids, like making a fort out of sofa cushions. And so, like, you listen to these acetates and you hear unmistakably, okay, this is the fruit of Kerouac's supposed jazz knowledge, and it's not good. Like, it's really lame. And I write in the book that our feeling listening to it, like hearing the pretty grandiose claims he made about his own musical abilities and then what he was actually able to do musically, there's a sort of a gap between those two experiences, which I say is like maybe sort of like the gap between what the child experiences as a fort and what mom sees when she walks into the living room and sees a pile of sofa cushions. And I think there's one reason why a lot of people hate on the Beats and kind of hate hipsters in general, which is a phenomenon of the last few years in particular. It seems like every lazy hack comedian has an I hate hipsters like bit that he does, right? And I think people really hate on hipsters because they can see there's something pretentious about this, because these people are literally pretending. But, you know, I quote Brian Eno somewhere in this, where Brian Eno's like, you know, if you say something's pretentious, aren't you actually complimenting it? You're saying that somebody's pretending. I think that pretending is the whole name of the game of art. Why do we hold that against artists? And I think that's a pretty good question to ask. So, you know, like, on the one hand, it'll boil down what I just said. On the one hand, no, I mean, you know, Kerouac was not much of a musician. On the other hand, it doesn't really matter. You know, what matters is the quality of the play and imagination that went into his fiction. And if he could create a persona for himself as this kind of jazz, as this kind of jazz hound, I don't know, more power to him.
And the aesthetic experience that he has, even if from the outside it seems diluted, it's not fake, right?
Right.
And in an aesthetic that privileges the experience, then the experience is real, even if it's not the experience that the musician making the music would recognize as an authentic experience of jazz. Like, it still happened for
exactly.
Kerouac. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, this notion that people's aesthetic experiences, whatever their source, however debased they may seem, are real and important, and spiritual experiences too, I would imagine, becomes very, very relevant when we move on into the next chapter, which is about hipness going mainstream in the 1960s. And here you draw on, again, a wonderful variety of sources. You kind of open the chapter with the liner notes to a Vladimir Horowitz record, which is positioned as hip, which I'm not sure that Horowitz would have had much use for, but it's really interesting to see how deeply this is penetrated now into advertising copy and everything else like that, at the same time that it's penetrating into, frankly, radical organizations who are trying to position themselves as far from advertising copy as they can possibly position themselves.
Right. Yeah. And yet there's this kind of, I don't know, I think it's a fundamental kind of paradox or something that has puzzled a lot of people, the seeming contradiction between an ethos or a sense that I call it a sensibility that's all about resisting the mass. I mean, that's like a really important thread that runs throughout this story, is the idea that what the hipster is doing is he sees through the delusions and folly and the false values of the mass culture and mass society. And you know, that's nowhere, right? And he wants to live it somewhere in his own self-created world of art and, you know, art and drugs and cool haircuts and so on. And the paradox is, like, how do you get a mass a mass sensibility of counterculture? How does an idea that's founded on the opposition of the discrete observer, the discrete judging observer from the mass, how does that become itself a mass ethic? So that's what this chapter is about. And okay, I just lost my train of thought. What was
No, I mean, that's very interesting, right? That you have this thing that's predicated on individuality. And if we trace the historical thread, this began in a case where there really was a subculture, right? Or a counterculture, which was that of the African American, urban experience in the, you know, the racist white society, essentially.
Yeah.
And then there's this, this very Baroque aesthetic version of that comes out, just in the way that people are living and dressing and engaging with music and talking to each other and the handshakes that they yeah. do and so on. And then you have a few intellectual observers who are kind of in the scene, kind of out of the scene. And the Beats are sort of a particular version of this, where they're looking at this and trying to extract the part of it that they find meaningful for their own aesthetic self-fashioning.
Yeah.
And then it gets to the point where everybody is doing this, right?
Right.
And now you have the whole society is identifying with that one group, except a lot of what made that specific in its original form has been washed away, right?
Right.
And you have lots of different versions of it, which are all specific to some corner of someone's experience. But what they have in common is the sense that, oh, I'm outside of the mainstream and I understand the rules of the game as they're right. being played.
Yeah, and this actually opens up one of the most, one of the thorniest questions in thinking about counterculture and hipness, and one of the questions that I wrestle with right from the very beginning is the problem of co-optation. Because the answer that everybody has kind of chambered when said, like, how do you end up with the mass ethic against the mass, is people say, oh, well, that's a co-optation. That's like a ripoff of something that's authentically hip, you know? So it's sort of like the, I mean, probably a lot of the people listening to this don't remember this, but like when Fruity Pebbles did like a rap thing, did you ever see that?
I think I've repressed that particular memory.
Yeah. It's just like one of those like really horrible novelty rap things that, you know, like in the 80s when rap is just being discovered by, I guess if you'd say mainstream pop culture. And so you see something like that, like a horrible fake rap on a Fruity Pebbles commercial. And you're like, well, that's clearly not Grandmaster Flash, right? That's not Eric B. and Rakim. That's some bullshit from Madison Avenue.
Yeah, yeah. That's not actual rap, essentially.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, you look at the 60s and you're like, oh, the Monkees versus the Beatles. One seems to be like a slick commercial co-optation of the other. The only thing is, and this is a thread which is not so much argued specifically in one place, but it just appears throughout. It runs like a thread throughout this whole story and my telling of it, is that it's really actually super hard to draw any kind of firm line between supposedly co-opted, supposedly inauthentic culture and some kind of supposedly authentic and pure counterculture. What happens is that, you know, the counterculture is the culture in the 60s. This idea of self-fashioning goes from being something that you're reading about to increasingly, this is just how people feel about themselves. This is how people understand their relationship to the world. And this becomes such a generalized ethos that it becomes almost hard to see as something historical, as something that had a birth and it had a certain kind of development. And here we are kind of in the middle of the story because we don't even see it as something separate from ourselves in the same way that a fish doesn't know that it's wet. And so I guess, you know, what I'm trying to say is like that trying to draw a line between what we think of as real and what we think of as co-opted or fake kind of obscures that larger reality that this sensibility, what really happens in the 60s is just a wholesale kind of revision from the inside, from like most kind of intellectually oriented kind of artsy sort of Americans and how they think of themselves. And this story is, and this is not original. I didn't dream this up. This aspect of the story of counterculture was first and very ably told by Thomas Frank in a book called The Conquest of Cool, which has become sort of a classic. And that book was another thing that kind of got me thinking about the whole idea of like writing about hipness, because, you know, like everybody else, I'd sort of took these ideas, the idea that society is essentially unfree and that you have to kind of resist it through a kind of a aesthetic self-creation. As I say, a fish doesn't know when it's wet. And for me, and probably for a lot of people, like reading Tom Frank's book was something that allowed a certain kind of distance from the idea. You suddenly could see it like, oh, that's an idea. That's not just the way things are. That's a particular form of self-fashioning that developed in the late 20th century, and I'm a part of that story.
As are we all, right? This aesthetic is still very, very much with us, dominantly. So.
Yeah. It gets complicated because people become aware of it. They're not free of it. They're not outside of it. They're just aware of it. And that's where I think a lot of this kind of hipster baiting, like, you know, stand-up comedians doing hipster baiting routines or whatever, where a lot of that comes from. Or like, I used to go to a pop music conference called EMP, Experience Music Project, pop conference, which is really good, has a lot of really good stuff. But it's really funny because you see a lot of like total indie rock hipsters walking around with t-shirts that advertise how ridiculous the idea of inauthenticity is, and yet are totally living out the reality of their experience, which is that they totally find some music authentic and other kinds of music fake. You know, somebody wearing a t-shirt saying your favorite band sucks is mocking the whole kind of hipster elitism of indie rock criticism, and yet they're also kind of still doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even recognizing that this system exists, right? Knowing that hipness is there means that you know the score, right? And therefore you are outside of it, or at least you position yourself slightly outside of it. And that's exactly the sort of the move that hipness entails all the way back to the beginning.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's funny because like I'm talking about like trying to do impossible things in scholarship. I'm trying to write about things that can't be written about. Presuming that I too am going to be, I am somehow going to succeed where everybody else fails, where I'm going to be able to successfully position myself outside of the sensibility. That is, of course, another kind of fallacious thinking, right? So kind of I can't do that any more than anybody else. So, you know, you're writing from inside the tent. You're writing about this sensibility necessarily as a part of it and to some extent blinkered by it. So that was another aspect of it that sort of fascinated me, that I was sort of doing something that on its own, like kind of doesn't make sense, or at least can never make full sense. It's never going to be a fully coherent project.
Yeah. But that's, I think what makes it such an exciting book to read is that you invite us to sort of go through these feedback loops with you.
Yeah.
And because hipness is something that's about experience, you have to, as a writer, put more of your experience into it than you would in a book on Beethoven sonata forms or something like that. And it makes it this is one of the more page-turny academic books that I've ever come across. And I think that that's a large part of why. Now, at the end of this chapter, you zero in on three different recordings: Charlie Parker's Ornithology, Ken Nordine's Sound Museum, and Bob Dylan's Ballad of a Thin Man, which are all in very different relationships to this idea of hipness and presence and outsider status. And I wonder if you could just say a couple of words about each of these and how they each instantiate this idea in their own particular way.
Yeah, okay. That's a good, that too is a good question. I wanted to kind of, one of the things in writing a book that's history is trying to nail something that's really hard to capture, which is the sense that things change. You know, there's historical change, and that change means something. It's not just random drift. It's not just like, oh, hems are up this year or they're down the next year. But then at the same time, while things change, there's also fundamental structures that remain in place. And so the period of time I'm talking about really runs from the 40s through the 60s. And if you look at the find an exemplary thing of what we can call hip culture, something that's at least in dialogue with what I'm calling hip culture, from each decade. 1940s, it's ornithology. 1950s, it's Sound Museum by Ken Nordine. 1960s, it's a really famous Bob Dylan track. They're all about 10 years apart from each other. The distance, the cultural distance between these three things is amazing. It's just huge. Like one, another thing that kind of stuck in my mind when I first started thinking about this was I was at one point really into the Modern Jazz Quartet. I don't know if you know the mod. I didn't end up writing about them, but you know, it's like, these are guys who are like playing jazz fugues, right? It's a quartet of like, you know, extremely advanced bebop musicians who also are getting some classical, like modernist classical music stylings in their mind. They're guys who wear finely tailored suits, and they'll, in an interview, they're as apt to talk about Stravinsky as they are Count Basie. They're modern guys. And, they're really, really big in the late 50s, like 1957, 58, 59. They're huge. Okay, move forward 10 years, 10 years, a mere 10 years. Think, you know, how what was happening in 2005. The musical landscape might have been a little different from 2015. It's not that different. What's the exemplary bit of hip culture we can talk about in 1969? Maybe the Woodstock Music Festival. And you look at any, just any act that you think of from like watching the movie Woodstock, like Hand Heat on the stage of Woodstock. On the one hand, this still represents, this is still in dialogue with a lot of the fundamental ideas of hip self-fashioning that I'm writing about. And yet it's totally different. It looks different. The idea of clothing, of style, of fashion is totally different. The idea of what the music is supposed to do, its relationship to tradition, all these things are really different. And so getting back to the three examples that I go through at the end of that fourth chapter, you know, what they have in common is, again, this sort of different ways of marking this idea of an inside and an outside, a critical insideriness and a kind of big square Nowheresville outsiderness. Or if you like, if you want to reverse the geometry of that, you know, being an outsider on the outside looking in, being in society but not of it. Each of these pieces in its own way, whether it's through a kind of really tricky modernist inside baseball manipulation of musical form that you see in ornithology, or whether it's through kind of verbal conceptual skits as it is in Ken Nordine's word jazz, or whether it's through a sort of performerly or performative presence that Bob Dylan cultivated in the mid-60s and used a very different kind of musical expression as a kind of platform for that. Regardless of the enormous stylistic differences and some very real kind of cultural differences in outlook between these three, you nevertheless do see this kind of stream of continuity, the way in which each of them is participating in this like large scale project of self-fashioning that, you know, a larger and larger number of Americans are getting involved with. By the end of the 60s, it seems like everybody's into it.
This hip aesthetic then kind of transcends boundaries of musical genre, right?
Yeah.
And musical technique, that there is still a common ground, although the differences are also very real, and you bring that out nicely. And then once you've outlined it as you have, it then becomes kind of a lens through which you can engage with almost any 20th century text, 20th century American text,
yeah,
right? I'm sure that you could find ones that it doesn't work for, but most things it's going to be relevant to. And then this is what I see you doing in the last two chapters of the book, is that you've taken two figures, one an absolutely canonical writer, Norman Mailer, and one a very, very fringe jazz musician, John Benson Brooks, and said, what can this hipness, as we now understand it, tell us about how we ought to be understanding both of these works? And in this way, I mean, it's this is a sort of a very traditional academic project in a certain mm-hmm. sense, which is that you say this is the aesthetic ferment that these people are living in. How should we reconsider this major figure, mm-hmm. right? Who is this minor figure that we ought to make more major? Although that's maybe not what you're quite about with John Benson.
Yeah, I try to avoid what Jeff McGee calls the trope of woeful neglect, because like everybody does that, right? It's like, yeah, you should listen to so-and-so more, and this guy who I just happened to have written a paper about, everybody should listen to him. Whereas, you know, like there is something stubbornly eccentric about Benson Brooks, where I'm not going to hold it against anybody if they don't listen to him. Although, you know, he wrote some really great music.
But let's deal with Mailer first, because this is someone that people are, you know, if they're not reading Mailer, they at least are dealing with Mailer, right? Mm-hmm. He's too important. What would you say is the particular version of hipness that informs Mailer's work as opposed to anybody else?
Well, it's very much Mailer's own idea, but like Mailer's, the big text to bring into this context is The White Negro, which is an essay that he wrote in 1957. And it's a capital G great text, which is to say, not necessarily that you're going to like it. It's not in some ways the easiest reading or the most pleasurable reading. And it says some things about blackness, about, African-American identity that is super problematic to, certainly to us. And for that matter, a lot of people, even at the time, famously James Baldwin, who wrote an excellent essay in counterpoint to it. But it's a great piece because it just demands attention. It's whether you like it or not, it's a sort of inexhaustible text, a really rich text. And I, like many, many other people who have written about this kind of culture, take a whack at understanding it. The way I'm trying to understand Mailer, though, is as somebody who, even though by all accounts was not a conspicuously musical guy, nevertheless conceived of his writing, both in writing of The White Negro and of all the stuff that came after it, as fundamentally a musical process or a musical project, which isn't to say that his music is, you know, his writing is euphonious. It's beautiful to listen to, or, you know, it's musical in the same sense that, like concrete poetry or something is. It's to say that he starts thinking of his writing as something that is analogous to what like a jazz musician is doing, that he's writing lines just as a jazz musician is playing lines. And his experience of writing is a fundamentally improvisatory one. He uses and perhaps overuses the word existential to describe it. But what he means by existential is something engaging upon an action where the outcome is in doubt. We don't know how it's going to turn out. And this idea, again, it absolutely plays into this central idea of hipness that I've been writing about by now for most of this book, right? It's the idea of hipness as an ethos of living your life as living, not, you know, as to enter into the here and now, being in the moment kind of participatory spirit of the thing. He is as aware as anybody else that that is what hipness represents. He's discovering this, again, it's not really a philosophy, it's like whatever it is, this ethos, this sensibility. He's discovering this for himself in the mid-50s when he's at low ebb. You know, he was like an overnight success when he published Naked and the Dead in 1948. And then he wrote a pair of novels where he's trying to get into a kind of Marxist sort of worldview that he sort of learned from Jean Malachet, who's a mentor of his. And he's just failing. I mean, like the books are getting terribly reviewed and nobody buys them. And his private life, his personal life is sort of that's not going how he planned it. And he feels sort of choked. He feels kind of strangled. And when he sort of discovers for himself this different worldview, this different way of being, it's sort of like enormously liberating to him, not only in his life, and he starts smoking a lot of weed, and there's a funny picture that I include in the book of him wearing like a little beret and with sporting a beatnik beard, which fortunately he shaved off quickly. It's not a good look on him.
Yeah, it's a funny picture, though.
Yeah. You know, it has effects on his life, and famously he gets a little insane and around 1961, stabs his then wife, gets maybe a little too much into the whole method acting, sort of like living out a certain kind of bad boy, wild man persona. But I'm more interested in what the effects are in his writing. And in his writing, you see the way in which he just really launches into a new kind of writing, which is all about this quasi-musical engagement with the moment in writing. The irony of that is, though, that took considerable skill. He was a writer of great skill. And just like the Beats, he found that, you know, like just banging out a sheet of completely unrevised prose is not actually the way to get to that voice, not the way to find that voice in yourself, that musical voice. And so one of the things I do in this chapter is I managed to unearth this cache of early drafts of the White Negro and find the pattern of revision. And the whole pattern of revision tells a tale about how he finds this voice, but it also shows him being very scrupulous in revision. There's something kind of contradictory about this, right? That you're, you know, using your powers as a writer and very carefully revising and discovering an improvisatory voice through this very introspective and careful and analytical writerly process. It's another one of the sort of paradoxes of hip self-fashioning that we keep stumbling into when we're in this territory.
That ideally, in his own theory, right, you ought to produce art the way that oysters produce pearls. Yep. You're just living, exactly. Right? And the art is almost a byproduct of that living exactly. experience. And it seems as if for him, that liveness, I guess, might be a better word than hipness precisely, is the ultimate good. It even supersedes conventional morality, right? That like, that certain criminal acts and horribly immoral acts could still be good in the sense that they are authentically alive, that they really come from the experience. And then in order to make this case effectively, he then needs to sort of, impose strictures on himself, which living without strictures was kind of the entire point. So yeah, it is, again, there's a sort of melancholy, to that when you look at it from the outside.
And although I get the impression, you know, Norman Mailer lived almost to 90 and, was enormously productive his entire life, lived to regret some of his excesses, some poor decisions he made. But, you know, I kind of get the feeling that Mailer, unlike Kerouac, who sort of was destroyed, I think, by some of the contradictions of the very territory that his writing opened up, Mailer learned to live with it. I mean, he managed to tame some of those demons and develop a kind of a stable relationship with them. You know, it's funny because he, the other big thing I write about in that chapter is his novel, An American Dream, which totally plays out what you just described, that sense of morality as something that drives a wedge between the good, the conventionally good, and the authentic. And he describes all kinds of enormities, all kinds of horrible things, murders and rapes and things that the main character does, which nevertheless is sort of articulated as part of this great open-ended existential quest of self-fashioning. But again, you know, that like, even though he sort of flirted with that idea in his life and even in his creations for a while, he was trying to direct movies. And if you go to YouTube, you can find a video that has been uploaded multiple times of Rip Torn attacking Norman Mailer with a hammer. have you ever seen that? It's crazy.
I've never seen that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, it's basically Rip Torn calling Mailer's bluff, like, oh, you want to live the fantastical violence of whatever of creation, here, take a hammer to the dome, see how you like that. But you know, for all Mailer was willing to act the clown on stage, he's actually willing to if as you say very, very aptly, that, you know, in this view, an artist creates art the way an oyster creates pearls. He was willing to let that process enact itself in public, and willing to fail and be ridiculous in public. In a way, that's it, yet another paradox or aporia that comes from this territory. It's kind of interesting that he's a guy who sort of who just tried so hard to be crazy in public and yet was the one who, as I say, found the most stable way to live with these demons. You know, he never, you know, once he kind of clicks into place in The White Negro, this idea of writing as a fundamentally musical and existential endeavor, he never varies from that. His writing style changes because he was a master prose stylist. So if you read Armies of the Night, it's in a totally different voice from the Executioner's song. It's not that he stays in one voice for the rest of his life, but he never stops thinking of writing in this fundamentally kind of musicalized way. And it's kind of interesting that he was a better able than the almost anyone else of the same literary generation to kind of live stably with that, to as I say, to kind of tame the demons, to find a way of living with them.
I want to follow up on something that you said just there. When he says writing is a musical act, music means, I think, something a little bit different than we might assume that it means.
Yeah. Right?
It's kind of, it's the part of music that means that at this particular moment, you have done a thing and a sound emerges from it, right?
Right.
Like that the record of sound is a distinct instinct,
yeah.
instant in time. Right. Rather than, you know, there are other definitions of music that you could certainly go into, but that seems to be the operative one.
Yeah.
And that also makes sense that jazz then is the music that he's connecting with so strongly because at least by reputation, jazz has this yeah. instantaneous, improvisatory quality where it's all about that particular instant, rather than about the composition or the arrangement or the chord progression even.
And the funny thing about that is also that, I mean, often jazz musicians kind of hate this when they see literary figures who aren't musicians, and Mahler's at the furthest thing from a musician, kind of hate it when people talk about jazz as if it's just something you just stick a horn in your face and blow and somehow jazz comes out. And yet it goes the other way, that actually that moment of like, I'm doing a thing and from that thing, this music is coming. And there's like the process of music making is, you know, that thin, razor thin edge of the now moving forward in time. That sense of nowness and aliveness and being in the moment is something that isn't just jazz. It's also absolutely fundamental to the experience of classical musicians. And you can think that classical music has very little to do with the kind of stuff that I'm writing about in this book. And yet, you know, when I talk about this material too, I teach at the Jacobs School of Music at Indiana University, which is almost all of the students I have are classical musicians. They have no trouble understanding what it was that Mahler saw in jazz, what he was on about, because that's their experience too.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And that's it's a matter of some debate recently in musicological circles. So I think that even people who don't really think of themselves as typically studying jazz will find an awful lot to think about in this book. So let's move on to the final chapter. When I was sort of, after I read this last chapter, I thought to myself, is this why he wrote the whole book? Had he heard this album and he needed to understand this album, and then it became necessary to go back to 1930, right? To go back to Zen and start from there. Now, as you've described it, that's not the case. And actually, I think it comes up in the book that you sort of talk about going back to the album, which you just had sitting around, after thinking about Hypnus and suddenly thinking, oh, wait a minute, there's more to this yeah. than I had thought. But I think that in this case, maybe the best thing to do is to begin with you just telling us, who is John Benson Brooks? Because he's probably not a figure that most people have heard of. Why is he important?
Well, John Benson Brooks is one of a whole bunch of people working on the East Coast. He's from Boston, but moves to New York in the early 1940s. He's part of a whole group of talented, ambitious, smart, young composer arrangers who start off their career employed in the tail end of the big band years, when there's still large touring orchestras that need composer arrangers. You know, those are outfits. That's a kind of jazz that's like very actually composer heavy. He studied at the New England Conservatory composition and piano, and from early on has this kind of interesting sort of multiple, he has multiple musicalities in him. That's a really weird phrase, but it's the best I can come up with. He's into composition. He listens to a lot of new classical composition, or what would have been new music at the time. He's really into Stravinsky and Schoenberg. And when he moves to New York, he gets really into John Cage. In fact, ends up studying with John Cage in one of Cage's famous composition classes at the New School. And yet, you know, he's also a jazz musician, and his early work is as a arranger and composer. So like he's particularly associated with one band, which is now kind of obscure, the Randy Brooks Orchestra. Randy Brooks, no relation, is a trumpet player, white trumpet player who had a really good orchestra. And, you know, Brooks wrote all their arrangements and wrote a lot of their tunes. He wrote arrangements and tunes for a lot of bands, and he even wrote a couple of hits. I don't know if you ever heard You Came a Long Way from St. Louis. That's a really well-known song. It's been covered by tons and tons of people. He wrote that. And his life ended up being a little bit like, you know, that Nick Hornby novel about a boy.
Sure. Yeah.
The main character, well, actually, confession, I never read the book. I saw the movie. But in the movie, Hugh Grant.
I know the movie, too.
Yeah, the Hugh Grant's dad, who he never meet. Hugh Grant lives this kind of, like, aimless life, right? The main character lives this aimless life of indulgence because he never has to hold down a job because his dad wrote a Christmas novelty hit, which earns so much in royalties that that's his income. And that's also his problem, that he is, his life kind of doesn't have a lot of shape to it. That's the story. That actually kind of happened with Brooks because he wrote You Came a Long Way from St. Louis and This Is the House That Love Built and a number of other songs that were like big hits, songs that like Frank Sinatra covered or whatever. But his thing was not being like kind of a self-indulgent wastrel like the figure in About a Boy. He was just like a really intellectual guy and just never happier than when he could just be alone in his study, playing piano, reading books, reading endless books, writing in his notebooks. He was a kind of almost graphomaniac keeper of journals. My point of entry into his work was this huge collection of all of his journals from the 1940s through the 1980s, this almost half century long project of writing down not only his life, but all of these researches, musical and intellectual and esoteric researches that he did. And he had just enough money that he could kind of get away with doing that. So he was like past the 1940s when all the big bands kind of started going away. He could be kind of choosy about what projects he got into. And the projects that he did, they were always the result of these highly intellectual researches that he was doing. There's only three albums by the guy. One's called Folk Jazz USA, which came out of the fascination he'd had with the idea of like marrying American folk music with advanced bebop. That was one of his ideas. Then there's another album, which is by far his best known, called The Alabama Concerto, which most jazz fans know is a Cannonball Adderley album, because Cannonball Adderley is on that album, which is a suite of compositions based on folk tunes, American folk tunes. But they're so abstractified and Stravinskyized that, what they really end up, it ends up feeling not like folk music at all, but like a sort of very modern jazz quartet, highly intellectual kind of modernist chamber jazz from the late 50s. And then his last album, which is the one I write about in the book called Avant Slant, which was issued after something like 12 years or a decade of really nobody hearing from him at all. And again, an outgrowth of these almost obsessive private studies. In this case, a 4-year project by which he and his partners developed a system of improvising 12-tone music, like serial music, like Arnold Schoenberg serial music. He came up with a system of tetrachordal improvisation in using serial means, which I'm not going to go into the math. I'm not going to do the math here and explain how that's possible, but it's all in the book. It's in a footnote.
And I will say you can go and listen to a little bit of this on YouTube. Someone's put Avant Slant up there and it sounds pretty convincing. The 12 tone improvisation stuff.
It's good. I mean, it should be good. He and the guys he was playing with rehearsed for 4 years, and then they got a gig at the International Festival of Jazz in 1962, played in between, sandwiched between Duke Ellington and Sonny Rollins, no pressure. And they played 20 minutes of this stuff in this language they had invented. It was like they had just spent 4 years inventing a language. And people didn't know what to make of it. It was brilliant. The recording exists. It's split up into little pieces on Avant Slant, so you can reconstruct the whole thing. It's brilliant, but it made almost no effect because it was like a really typical John Benson Brooks thing where he'll spend years cogitating, thinking through a system. He was a real system builder. And then he'll create a piece of music in this newly developed language, and there's no context for it. Nobody knows what to make of it because the researches that went into it are really obscure. And Avant Slant ended up being kind of a combination of two projects. One was The 12s. That was the name he gave to his 12-tone jazz project. And the other was this kind of musique concrète-like project of like recording just found sounds. He was really into found sounds before it was cool. He would just tape things off of the TV or the radio and arrange them into kind of compositions, tape music compositions. And so Avant Slant was this weird Frankenstein's monster creation where he's like, oh, this is how I can put these two projects together. And this is, and you know, it came out in 1968, and this was the late 60s when the recording industry just didn't know what the kids were into these days. They didn't have the slightest clue. And so this is this really interesting period of time where there's a kind of throw it at the wall and see if it sticks kind of thing going on. And so somehow this crazy project that I've described, it's even weirder sounding than the way I've described it. This shotgun marriage of like 12-tone jazz and music concrete. That sounds like the most unsaleable thing ever, right? But Decca Records gave him a $5,000 advance, which is something like $35,000, $40,000 in our money, to create this thing. He labored for 2 years to create this thing, and then it came out and nobody cared. Like, it sold no copies. It was a complete disappointment, and then just disappeared. Just another recording, another of the tens of thousands of recordings in the archive that, you know, you'll never hear of and never listen to. And I, you know, I just accidentally ran into this record, you know, collected this record, and then later discovered that there was this huge cache of notebooks and this really interesting guy who had developed this really interesting and incredibly detailed intellectual artistic project over decades. There was this whole backstory to the record. So I'm sorry, I'm looping back to where you started, and you were saying that it almost seems like the book was written in order to explain this guy. I actually made this felicitous discovery right at the end, like towards the end of writing the book. I was in the Rutgers Institute of Jazz Studies archive, and I was researching something else. I was researching like early jazz, like early 40s jazz periodicals, like little music publications like the Music Dial, which are really hard to find anywhere. And I was looking at one thing and just bumped into a stack of other things, and included in that was like a bunch of Avant Slant materials. And I just saw Avant Slant written on the box, in the container in this archive. And I was like, God, why does that ring a bell? Oh, yeah, that really weird album that I listened to like 5 minutes of before my wife told me to turn it off. Yeah, that. And it was really strange because it was sort of like coming at the end of this long process of thinking about this sensibility and all the different kinds of music that go into it and all of the different kinds of artistic projects that form a part of it, running into this guy who, in his sort of strangely multifarious creative project, almost sort of summarized all of them, even to the extent that a lot of the names of people who had come up and elsewhere in my research, people like, you know, Seymour Krim, for example, suddenly popping up in this guy's story, in John Benson Brooks' story. He seemed to be sort of like that figure Zelig from that Woody Allen movie. You know, a guy who's like kind of an obscure guy who isn't really known for anything except that he always manages to be off in the corner of really famous historical tableau. That's John Benson Brooks. And so like this felicitous discovery at the end of the process of researching this book, it kind of allowed me to gather together a lot of the strains of things I'd written about in other chapters.
And it really comes together so nicely. Like, had it been planned that way from the start, it would have made total sense. And it feels almost as if it had been, which is nice. You know, it's great when things just sort of naturally work out that way. Because the album, Avant Slant, it's like, it's the perfect hip text in that to get it, to dig it, you would kind of have to be John Benson Brooks.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you have this archive that you can dig into, this vast, compulsive, diaristic archive, which allows you to almost get inside his head. So that if you were to go, you know, if all of us were to take a field trip to that archive, immerse ourselves in it for 6 months, then I think the album would sell once we had all done that, right?
I'd like to think so. Yeah, but, you know, even that's another one of those kind of vanishing points, another one of those points where you can kind of get close, but you can never reach the absolute point. The point of the absolute is just like, yeah, you can come really close to being in his head. But the whole thing about his art is it is so much an art that grows out of his life. Again, to use your wonderful metaphor before, like an oyster makes the pearl. You know, his artwork and Avant Slant, it grows out of the archive, but the archive itself is a kind of a capital G, capital W, great work, in the same sense that like hermeticists understand the great work, a project of personal illumination. And to really get it, you would have to actually, as you say, you would have to be John Benson Brooks, which clearly I am not. And that marks another vanishing point. You know, this brings up the idea of music as practice, an idea that music can be I don't want to say liberating, but there's something redemptive, something really beautiful and wonderful that the hip sensibility has always kind of gone after, has always promised a sense of the creation of an interval for freedom, an interval for play, even in the very strictly ruled boundaries of modern life, that there's always a room to be who you are and to play, you know, like a kid building a sofa fort. That it's a musical practice, a kind of almost purposeless practice, or not purposeless, but like the purpose is the play. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. Or if there's a broader purpose, it doesn't matter if the purpose is achieved.
Yeah.
That had Benson Brooks never come out with Avant Slant, if he had just done the ritualistic stuff that he did, and you have this wonderful event score for The Life of John Benson Brooks,
or yeah.
The player is to create a great work. To this end, he subjects himself to a continual self-directed schooling and so on.
Yeah.
He would still be one of the hippest people ever to have that be his life. So yeah. The life becomes kind of the hipness. And it's interesting that at the end you kind of offer that to us. If you are playing the piano every day, what does that mean for you? That's kind of a hip thing to do if you care enough to do it.
Yeah. Except that it, as I say somewhere in there, it's not something you can do on TV. You know, it's not something you'll ever get famous for. And like, there's always this kind of contradiction in the heart of the hip sensibility, that there are some like, there's some people like John Benson Brooks who take it all the way to an extreme where it's all about personal gnosis. It's about personal illumination. It's about creating a space for somewhere of that space of play. And you just don't care who might be overhearing you. But then there's also the other side of it, which is the sort of Bob Dylan side, where the idea that what you're doing is, since this is a project of consciousness, you're changing consciousness by creating a counterculture, a culture that will stand as a bulwark against all that crappy consumerist drag that we're constantly drowning in. And that idea that that's a kind of a contradiction, right? There's a kind of an instability, a tension in this sort of hit sensibility around the idea of doing culture to save culture from itself. And I am kind of holding out the sort of the idea of the kind of being willing to just kind of go about your life and finding your meanings in your life, and not relying on somebody with a cool haircut on TV to sort of model that for you. Except that doesn't end up necessarily looking very hip. Like, you might think that from what I'm saying, I'm arguing that Avant Slant is the ultimate hip record. It's the hippest record ever. No, it's not. Like, it's actually not even that good. I sure as hell don't listen to it for fun. For a while, I had it on my iPod, and I would be cooking dinner, and every now and then, Avant Slant would just come up in shuffle mode, and it became a family joke. It's just like, oh my God, turn that thing off. I'm not saying it's a particularly, even a particularly great album, but I'm also saying that that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter. One example that I give of why that kind of evaluation just doesn't matter when we're talking about practice is thinking about an experience that a lot of parents have. Like, if your daughter plays like Suzuki violin, and you go to one of those end of the year concerts where all of the kids who play Suzuki violin in your kid's class get up and play a little solo. They all get up and play Go Tell Aunt Rhody. And anybody who's had a child play in one of those, and this is like the least hip scenario that I'm pointing out, right? This is like rituals of bourgeois life in America in the 21st century. Anybody who's had that experience has had the experience of experiencing this vast Sahara of boredom. It's so boring hearing one scratchy, out of tune performance of Go Tell Aunt Rhody after another, except for that one interval when your own child is playing, in which case you might as well be listening to Heifetz, right? You might as well be listening to the greatest violinist who ever lived, because your experience in that moment is like you're transfixed. Does it make sense? What kind of jerk would say, like, well, it wasn't really very good, objectively speaking, 6 out of 10. Like, who would do that with their own kid? Like, you can do that with other people's kids, but not yours. Because that's your experience. Because practice isn't about objective standards of whether you're really any good or not. It's about the cultivation, again, the cultivation of experience, but a cultivation of that interval for play and self-fashioning, which otherwise sometimes is, you have to fight for that. Like, you have to fight for your right to party. You have to fight for that space of unruled, unbounded, purposeless play, which our culture seems absolutely intent on exterminating at times.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we let you go, I have two more quick questions. One is there any facet of the book that we didn't cover that you'd like to bring up now as a parting shot?
No. I think we did it.
Excellent.
We did my book.
All right. And then the second question is, what are you currently working on?
I am writing, actually, a lot of the stuff that I got into with the Mailer and Benson Brooks chapters, which has to do with mysticism, magic, modes of being, which are like radically experiential. That's the stuff that really stuck with me. And so I'm spending a lot of time thinking about mysticism and magic, and kind of more abstractly, something which is sort of present but not front and center in Dig, which is the problems of modernity, the kind of the post-Enlightenment, the sort of era, the modern era, the last, you know, 300-400 years, and the way that generates certain forms of thinking and also makes certain other forms of thinking almost unthinkable, especially magical forms of thought, and the recuperation of magical forms of thought in modernity, and particularly in modernism and modernistic forms of art, is something that like really fascinates me. So I have a blog, Dial M for Musicology. You can Google it. And a lot of the stuff that I've been thinking about along those lines, I put a lot of that stuff up on that blog. So people who are interested in that can follow up there.
Sounds like a fascinating project. And I hope that you'll come back and visit us again when you get through with it.
Happy to do it. Yeah.
Well, thank you again very much for joining us here on New Books in Music.
Thanks so much.